Hello and welcome to this installment of Conversations at Jackrabbit Slims. And this episode, I am thrilled to welcome to the show fellow podcaster and film and TV critic, Liam Dempsey. Liam, welcome.
Hello, sir. How you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. And this is sort of a long time in the making, and I'm glad we finally able to sit down and have worked our schedules out. We're both able to chat, but we've got a podcast connection going on that's been going on for years. You do a podcast called Spocklight, which we'll talk about in a minute. But I think did we initially connect via Spocklight, or was it through my Stallone podcast, The Slycast?
Oh, I'm not sure, mate. I mean, I know that, because you're a Star Trek guy as well, aren't you? You used to have a Star Trek podcast, didn't you?
Yeah. One of my early podcasts was scene-specific commentary for every episode of the original classic 60s version of Star Trek. So there's different ways I connect with people. It's either through Star Trek or through Stallone and Rocky. So I know we have both in common, so...
Yeah, so I reckon what probably happened is when we were starting out with Spocklight, obviously, you know, you have a look at the other Star Trek podcasts out there and kind of follow people on that, on social media, who are involved. And I think I probably found you through that, seeing that you did host a Star Trek podcast, but then saw that you also hosted the Slycast and started listening to that right from the start. And that's probably how it happened, because I really, kind of binged the Slycast when I discovered it.
Excellent. And now we have Pulp Fiction in common as well. But I do want to ask you for those who aren't familiar with your podcast, Spocklight, I know it's a unique approach to Star Trek, and there are a lot of Star Trek podcasts out there. So being unique definitely helps. Can you explain to people what the show is and where they can find it?
Yeah, so basically the idea of Spocklight is it offers kind of fresh perspective on the Star Trek franchise, because as you say, there is a lot of Star Trek podcasts out there. When we started the podcast, me and my co-host Matt and Paul, none of us were massive Trekkies or anything. You wouldn't find us at conventions dressed up as Klingons or anything like that. We were all kind of reasonably outsider, but with kind of differing levels of fandom. Like with me, like I'd seen episodes here and there, but never watched a series properly. But I had seen all the films. But that was more out of being a film buff rather than kind of a Star Trek buff. Matt had literally just seen the first two JJ movies.
Okay.
That's all he'd ever seen. And with Paul, Paul was the one who was the biggest fan, but he'd like lapsed in terms of when he was a kid, he did watch Next Generation and Voyager and that, but since then he kind of buried it away. Like, you know, he got beaten up one too many times. That was it. and so, he kind of forgot about it. And we were like, right, okay, we could do this. And we kind of started it out as just doing a movie podcast, really. We just wanted to find a film series that we could do a podcast on, kind of inspired by James Bonding, the Matt Myra and Matt Gawley mm-hmm. podcast, where they go for all the Bond movies. We were like, yeah, let's just find a long series we can do. And we did the Star Trek movies. So we started with the movies and we kind of never intended to go beyond that.
Yeah.
However, once we started, not only did we start building an audience, but we just also really, really enjoyed it. And we were getting some great guests together and it just literally spurred us to go on. And you know, now we will be coming up to our 5-year anniversary in September. And we've done over 80 episodes. So, you know, it's pretty crazy, but it's been an absolute ride. I love it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, the most important thing about podcasting is getting joy out of it. And, you know, that's number one, you know, over anything else. So, good on you for finding something that, you guys can maintain together and enjoy doing. I'll include a link to the podcast there, but I got to say that you sort of downplay the guests you've gotten. One of your early episodes, you guys interviewed Richard Donner, which is a really big deal.
Oh yeah. No, it was pretty crazy. Like what it was is we interviewed Robert Salin, who is the producer of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And I mean, that, that was a big get, obviously, in itself. Like, you know, the producer of kind of like, you know, most, the most beloved Star Trek movie, I would say. And that was a big thing for us early on. And he was a lovely, lovely guy. And he's become a friend of the podcast. He's been on twice now. But basically, he was old pals with Richard Donner. They're like really, really close chums. Bob was actually the second unit director on Assassins because just because they're old pals. And he, off the back of that, was kind enough to kind of give us a contact to Dick Donner, and we ended up interviewing him. And it's one of those things where essentially there's no real Star Trek connections with Richard Donner, but we were like, you know what? It's Richard Donner. Who cares? Like, we're getting
exactly.
And we've got, and we managed to get like, you know, like almost an hour and a half interview with him. So proper career retrospective. And although he's never directed any Star Trek, he, of course, because he's Dick Donner, he has like got connections because he directed the famous William Shatner episode of The Twilight Zone, where he's on the plane.
Yeah.
He directed Conspiracy Theory, where Patrick Stewart plays the bad guy. So, you know, there's lots of things going on there. And he was just an incredible interviewee. And of course, you know, there is a connection because, he directed Assassins, which is a Stallone movie. And of course, you're a big Sly fan yourself. And yeah, I was just amazing chatting to him, and he was such a good sport at the end of the day, because I think he had no idea what it was going to be. I think at the time when we interviewed him, he'd never done a podcast before. Since then, he's done a few. He's gone on the Leonard Maltin podcast and the Gilbert Godfrey podcast and stuff. So we kind of feel like we gave him the bug of it, but he, I don't think he even really quite knew what a podcast was when he came on. And you know, to that point, of course, what he was lovely enough to do is, at the time, give us the exclusive on the in-development Lethal Weapon 5. At the time, he kind of just dropped that news out of nowhere on the show. And then it got picked up by all the major movie news sites. And suddenly, like within like a week of that podcast coming out, we were on every major movie news site, like, you know, embedded in there because we'd interviewed Donner, he dropped this news about Lethal Weapon 5. Obviously, sadly, it hasn't happened, but, you know, it was still really cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I can only imagine. And I got to say, I love when professionals in the public eye appear on independent podcasts, because I still think that that's where the true heart of podcasting lies, is in, you know, I don't want to discount anybody by calling them a fan, but Richard Donner being interviewed by people that have enjoyed and experienced his movies in the theater as paying customers, as opposed to somebody like Leonard Maltin, and no offense to Leonard Maltin, he's a tremendous interviewer, but who's made a career out of being, you know, a film appreciator and a critic. Those are two different dynamics. And I, for me, I'm more inclined to listen to a podcast that's coming from an independent standpoint or viewpoint, just because you're going to get better questions. Also, I mean, Richard Donner is such a great interview because he was one of those guys that worked in TV when TV was still like the hot shit medium before film really took over. So he was there for that transition, which I'm sure was exciting. And I'll link to the interview in the show notes, and I'll also link to the podcast, but great job doing what you guys do. And I know how hard podcasting is, how difficult it can be, especially when there's multiple people involved. So congrats on 80 episodes. That's quite a feat.
Thanks, man. I mean, the joy of it for us is we just keep changing things up at the end of the day. We're always changing kind of the perspective of what we're doing, whether it be kind of, you know, actually concentrating on episodes of the TV series or kind of exploring a movie which features a member of Star Trek alumni, either in front or behind the camera, or kind of, you know, just doing different things with it and finding new ways to explore the franchise. I think that's what keeps it fun, and it's such a wide-ranging universe that you can do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So since it's been talked about, and we're on a Quentin Tarantino-themed podcast, and while we're talking about Star Trek, I was curious if you had any feelings on you know, the rumors that have been around for years that Tarantino was going to pen an R-rated version of Star Trek, which would be the next big screen movie. Do you have any feelings on that? And, you know, Tarantino sort of joining the Star Trek universe?
Yeah, I mean, mate, I'd love it. I'd love it at the end of the day. You know what I mean? It's one of those things. I am completely pro Tarantino coming on and doing his take on Star Trek. And frankly, now with the abundance of Star Trek TV shows that we currently have, I think there's the room for someone like Tarantino to just come along and do his take and just be a completely individual. This is the Tarantino Star Trek and that's it. Without having to really worry about it being the only thing out there representative of Star Trek, I think now there's enough out there you can just have fun and go, yeah, sure, we'll do a Tarantino Trek movie. Like, let's do it. And, you know, at the end of the day, Tarantino is an absolutely incredible filmmaker. For my money, he has never directed a bad feature film.
Yeah.
I think every movie, like, literally, even his weakest film to me is still very good. And I think I think it's undeniable that he'd do something decent with it. I don't think he's going to do anything bad. He might do something that, you know, upsets some fans, but frankly, there are Star Trek fans who are always going to be upset by literally anything that you do. Like, so.
Oh, yeah.
I think it would be awesome. I'd love to see it. What about you?
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's interesting, Liam, because it doesn't seem like theatrical Trek is really where Paramount and CBS are interested in sort of pursuing things. You know, they're content to do what, there's going to be four series pretty soon between Discovery, Lower Decks, Picard, and the new one with Anson Mount playing Pike.
Plus Star Trek Prodigy as well. So
yeah,
five.
So five. So yeah, you know, that's a good point you made that, you know, it's almost safer now. Now is probably the safest time to do something different, you know, theatrically. You know, I always, you know, believe that Quentin will do what's right for a project. But it would definitely be interesting to see him play in that world because, you know, it's a lot different than what he's done. And he's made some very varied films. So, yeah, I'd be curious to see it. And, you know, it's always also cool to see Tarantino scripts directed by other people. And I know as much as he probably regrets selling it, True Romance is the movie it is because of Tony Scott. And then also as much as he hates it, he's claimed to never see it. But Natural Born Killers is another one. I'm not really interested in seeing a Quentin Tarantino directed Natural Born Killers, but the Oliver Stone treatment was amazing. So yeah, anytime there's Tarantino scripts being directed by other people, I think that's a really unique situation. And, you know, as much as I love him as a director, you know, it's kind of a shame we didn't get more scripts, you know, well, you know, directed by other people. We got From Dusk Till Dawn, I guess, which is another one that, you know, that's a Robert Rodriguez movie. You know, Tarantino isn't going to make the same movie. So, yeah, it would be neat.
Yeah, no, that's much more Rodriguez film. And yeah, I've got to completely agree about Natural Born Killers. I've got to be honest, I think True Romance and Natural Born Killers, they're so similar in concept that you needed someone like Oliver Stone to come along and do a wildly different take. I don't care if Tarantino doesn't like it. Natural Born Killers is a wicked movie. And it's wicked because of Stone's interpretation.
Yeah, well, I mean, Oliver Stone knew that it needed to have elements of satire, and it would have been a really hard movie to watch if he hadn't done that. I mean, just look at the scene, you know, with Mallory coming home to her dad, played by Rodney Dangerfield, and they set it up, and it plays like a sitcom episode with a laugh track. That scene played straight could be really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's that thing where, you know, I think it, for me, I love True Romance, but I think Natural Born Killers is the better, more original film.
Absolutely. And that was a time period where I would say that probably between 89 and 95, like, Oliver Stone was operating on a level as a filmmaker that few people have touched. And I also think that Oliver Stone doesn't get as much credit for influencing the look and feel of films in the 90s and beyond. I mean, he was really one of the more popular directors to put forth that sort of MTV style of filmmaking. And it sounds really cheap now, but using different film formats, just really, really experimental stuff, but you're doing it in these big budget, highly commercial films. And I think if you watch, you know, The Doors, JFK, Natural Born Killers, you know, there's probably a handful I'm forgetting, but Oliver Stone was, like I said, he was functioning on a much higher level than a lot of filmmakers. And, you know, it's kind of a shame that I think he kind of went down a conspiracy road, and I think he lost interest in really being that kind of filmmaker. And he, you know, he went on to do some other stuff, but I think I'd put like that run of Oliver Stone films up against anybody's filmography. And it can hold its own, except for maybe John Carpenter, who's got probably the most, you know, unimpeachable filmography.
There are those certain directors who just have a string of fucking rock solid, like, hits under their belt. Like, for me, Francis Ford Coppola in the 70s.
Yep.
You look at, he only released four films, but they're The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now. That's a pretty amazing decade in film.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, if you look at John Carpenter, he's got multiple masterpieces, which is amazing. You know, he's got Halloween, he's got The Thing, he's got Big Trouble in Little China, he's got They Live, and those movies all mean things to different people. And you know, again, it's fitting that we're talking about it—an incredible run of films. You know, Tarantino has. So let's get into it, Liam. What was your initial introduction to Tarantino, and did it start with Pulp Fiction, or was there a different jumping on point?
Pulp Fiction would have been my first Tarantino. Yeah, I would have seen it sometime in the late 90s on TV. I'm not sure if it was the premiere on British TV, which would have been like late 1997 time, but it might have been another airing of it in the late 90s. But yeah, late 90s time. So when I was kind of like a teenager.
Mm-hmm. And would that be something that airs like on, and forgive me my ignorance of TV over there, but would that be something that just aired on like BBC?
Yeah. So it was 100%, it was BBC Two. It would have aired on. And yeah, it would just have aired, like, I think it was on a Saturday night, at like, you know, 10:30 PM at night or something, so it could go out uncut. Because, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, you know, it's very different in the US. I know, like, often, you know, TV, and there's TV edits of movies and stuff like that. And obviously, films get edited over here as well when they're on, like, pre-watershed. But if you're on after the watershed, so after 9 PM in the UK, you're going to get the film uncut, basically, usually, because it's like all the kiddies should have gone to bed by now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like BBC Two would have screened it about 10:30 at night on a Saturday night, and late 90s, and I watched it then. It might have been like the second time it was on British TV or something. And, yeah, so I would have been like probably like 13 watching it or something like that. And, you know, obviously I was really ravenously into movies when I was a kid from a very early age. So I knew Tarantino was a big deal. Obviously knew what Reservoir Dogs was and everything like that. Well, I had seen it because Reservoir Dogs was actually banned in the UK on VHS for a while.
Okay.
It came out of the cinema, but it was banned for years on home video. And yeah, I watched it and I was straight away absolutely blown away. I mean, it's what I would describe as a game changer movie for me, because, you know, prior to Tarantino movies, no one had dialogue like that in movies. It was a whole new way of kind of, you know, writing dialogue in films. And we know it massively influenced so many filmmakers that came after.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just immediately, as soon as you watch that opening scene with Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer, and then the following kind of scene with Travolta and Samuel L, and they're just chatting, like, the dialogue is so incredible. And it is just immediately, you were so in and entranced by the conversations that were being had, because it's like you've never heard dialogue so punchy with such rhythm to it, you know? And yeah, it was just a completely eye-opening experience for me.
Excellent. Yeah, you know, it's not funny, but it's funny because I think that's a lot of people's experience. It was mine. You know, for me, that was sort of my cinematic, you know, awakening, and it made me aware of filmmaking as a process, as opposed to just a story I was watching on screen. And I really think that that is a part of Tarantino's legacy, if you will, that I don't think gets acknowledged as much now, but, you know, sort of the things that Tarantino popularized enough to make it acceptable for audiences to get on board with it was, you know, a filmmaker taking his time, you know, setting up a world, but then also getting us to know their characters through conversations, and not conversations that were pointless. I mean, if you look at all the dialogue in Pulp Fiction, just about every conversation that two characters have, it's either referencing something that's already happened or it's setting up something that's going to happen later. And, you know, it's really hard to set the table in movies, I think. And that's something Tarantino's really good at. And I think sometimes with his nonlinear approach, you don't really see the table being set.
Yeah, I mean, with Pulp Fiction, it's that thing of you have the two prologues, don't you, before you even get into the separate stories. And I think it's such a clever approach, because before we even get to the first proper chapter, the first individual kind of Pulp Fiction tale, we're already so invested in the world we've been introduced to, and kind of just, it literally, you just kind of feel like you're luxuriating in amazing kind of dialogue and great performances. You know, that opening scene with Tim Roth is so, so good. So good, in fact, that I, when I was studying for my Lambda, which is a sort of kind of drama kind of qualification, back when I was a teenager, I actually performed that opening scene as a duologue with an actress. Literally just because it was just, the dialogue is so amazing. So it was just, so I played the Tim Roth role doing that for my final like distinction kind of evaluation. And yeah, it's so much fun. Like just that dialogue just sings, man. And then,
yeah,
you know, when you go into the conversation between Vincent and Jules about kind of his trip to Amsterdam and everything like that, I always wonder when I watch it, I'm like, did Burger King sales go down? And McDonald's sales go up as a result of this.
Excuse me. Yeah, that's a great point. I do want to talk about Tim Roth a little bit, because, you know, Tim Roth was in Reservoir Dogs and he was doing an American accent, and in Pulp Fiction he was able to sort of use his real voice, which I think is really cool, because Tim Roth is great at delivering Tarantino dialogue, and that opening sequence with him and Amanda Plummer is great. It's such a cool introduction to that world, and the way they play off each other, you can tell that they're two people that know each other, you know. And sometimes, you know, you watch movies and it's, you can just, you can sort of see the acting going on, but in that opening sequence of Pulp Fiction and most of Tarantino's movies, because they're cast so well, you don't really see the, you know, the lines, if you will, in the curtain of the filmmaking. And, you know, it's rare that I get lost in films now, but Pulp Fiction's still a movie that I'm able to get lost in, even knowing all the behind the scenes sort of goings on.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It's like Pulp Fiction is one of those films. I mean, I've seen it, you know, fuck knows how many times, but it's that thing of, I rewatched it for this podcast. I've seen it, the last time I saw it was like, I don't know, like 2 years ago or something like that. And it's just a film that it just washes over you at the end of the day at this point. And it's like, and I would say Pulp Fiction is the film I probably know the most dialogue from. It's like the most quotable movie, like, you know, for me, probably. But like, and you could just enjoy that dialogue. And it's so funny you say about Tim Roth is brilliant at delivering Tarantino dialogue. And that's why he's an actor. He's used again and again. But it's like you get Tim Roth delivering the dialogue. And then you're like, oh, he's fucking amazing. And then the next scene, suddenly, of course, for the first time, we get Samuel L. Jackson delivering Tarantino dialogue. And then you go, oh, shit. Because Tarantino himself says no one could deliver my dialogue like Samuel L. Jackson. And he's fucking right. He's like, I mean, what a fucking synchronicity between a writer, director, and an actor there. Because before this, Samuel, he was like, you know, a small-time character actor. And then with this, it takes him to the absolute stratosphere where, like, now, like, Samuel Jackson tends to be the actor Moses has seen in the most films. He's so ubiquitous going, like, you know. And just immediately, like, yeah, of course, because in this movie, despite already being 46 years of age when he's in this film, he comes across as so youthful, so energetic, so full of energy, like in those scenes. You're just like, holy shit, who is this guy? The way he kind of spouts the Tarantino dialogue is just, you know, no one can match that, you know?
Oh, yeah. And it's kind of interesting because I think a lot of people forget that this movie was nominated for a lot of Oscars. Sam Jackson was nominated for best supporting actor, and Travolta was nominated for best actor. And it's unfortunate because I think the Jules performance is more than a supporting role. But at the same time, it was in a year where you had Martin Landau playing Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood. And I think if Ed Wood came out a year earlier or a year later, it's unquestionable that Samuel L. Jackson would have gotten the Oscar. And that's not to take anything away from Martin Landau's performance, because his Bela Lugosi was amazing. But I think Sam Jackson's performance as Jules was the better performance for the reasons you explained. He exploded on screen as sort of this character actor who had finally been given his, you know, sort of, you know, a ticket to the big dance. And he completely nailed it. And it's a performance so different than performances that we were used to seeing, you know, at that time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love Ed Wood. I think it's Tim Burton's best film. And Martin Landau is great as Bela Lugosi in it. However, I'm sorry, but in terms of, like, you know, what has stood the test of time, Samuel Jackson's performance as Jules is the more iconic than kind of like Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi. And it's going to be the one that's going to be remembered. And like, that is one of those ones you look at. Cause I actually, it was nominated for loads of awards. I think it only won best original screenplay, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, which is nuts, isn't it? It's just one of those ones you look at and go, this is now thought of rightly as, I would say most people regard it as Tarantino's masterpiece. Yes, there are people who go, you know, people come out of left field, they're like, oh, I prefer Jackie Brown, actually. Like, going, like, yeah. But most people would go, yeah, Pulp Fiction is the absolute one. And it's that thing where it's just kind of like, yeah, you know, the Oscars always, when you look back at their choices, often seem so fuddy-duddy in what they choose, kind of, you know, for the, well, I've got one of the classic, funny enough. Obviously, I love Rocky. I absolutely fucking love it. But, of course, 1976, Taxi Driver at the same time. And it's one of those things where you go, I love Rocky. I genuinely think it is a classic, a brilliant movie, and I don't begrudge it winning Best Picture. But at the same time, when you put Rocky up against Taxi Driver, you go, what is the better film? I think it's a struggle to say, like, Rocky is better than Taxi Driver. You know what I mean? In terms of, and I'm speaking as someone who thinks Rocky is a masterpiece, and I love it. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, and that's ultimately why you can't really get too worked up about award shows, because basically it's just a snapshot of what the voting audience was thinking at the time they made their vote. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of people that voted for Rocky for Best Picture that if they could go back in a time machine, they'd change their vote. So at the end of the day, if a movie means something to you and a performance means something to you, that's all that really matters.
Yeah, 100%. And they shouldn't go back. They shouldn't go back, Craig, because at the end of the day, I like that Sly won Best Fucking Picture. I like, Marty doesn't need it. Marty doesn't need to win Best Picture in 1986. Sly still needs it, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's also interesting because you wonder, like, I mean, Stallone's career is so interesting. That's why I do a podcast about it. But, like, it's so interesting to see his career, you know, post, you know, Rocky, before Rocky became a franchise and before Rambo. You know what I mean? You've got this really weird filmography of an actor trying to find his footing and then finally saying, oh, well, screw it. I'm going to give people what they expect from me and not what I want to do.
Yeah.
And he did it with tremendous success and it's commendable. But I mean, like, look at, like, you know, a movie like Fist.
Yeah, you know I want you to talk Fist, right? You know I want you to talk Fist.
Yeah.
It is so, that film, I always, even though it is not a perfect movie, far from it. Like, I think it's, you know, it's what I describe as a curio of a film.
Yeah.
But I would recommend it to anyone who, I don't know, just hasn't seen enough Stallone movies. Because you look at Fist, and I think it's like a perfect demonstration of what Sly kind of could have gone on to rather than what he did. Like, and so many of those movies from that era, like Fist, like Nighthawk, stuff like that, where you go, oh, they're interesting kind of films of that era where Stallone is being an actor first and star second. And even, you know, First Blood, which is incredible and a masterpiece at the end of the day. First Blood is, you know, obviously nothing like the other Rambo movies. And that is a proper film at the end of the day. It's a proper film, really dramatic, intense movie with a really downbeat ending. And Stallone is incredible in it in terms of performance. You're still like, that's 1982 at the end of the day, so you were quite far in from Rocky, and he's still very much concentrating on being an actor first. And then suddenly, I think it's the double header, isn't it, of Rocky IV and First Blood Part II, where literally he just goes, right, yeah, that's it, hand me the oil. I've been in the gym for 5 months. Let's fucking go for it. And literally, then it becomes very much Sly, the star, super Sly. Yeah. And then he goes down a completely different road until we get to Copland, which unfortunately ends up being kind of, you know, just this shot in the dark without any kind of follow up. I love Copland. It's an incredible film. I wish that he'd done more in that vein, but he seemed to just completely go off against that and try to get back to doing what he was before or afterwards.
Yeah, I think there's a story there, because I know that he had, if I remember correctly, a 3-picture deal with Miramax. And I don't know if Harvey did him dirty. I mean, Harvey seemed like the type of person that did a lot of people dirty. Professionally, I know there's a story behind Copland, and I would love to know the real reason that Sly didn't make more movies for Miramax. And it's interesting, Liam, if you create sort of this alternate universe where Stallone stopped after Rocky II, would we end up with Tarantino casting him in one of his 90s movies?
Well, let's bring it back to QT, because of course, one of the interesting things for me with this is one of the things I remembered was back in the day, it was heavily rumoured that the original plan for Inglourious Basterds was to cast all the old 80s action stars in the lead role. So Arnie, Sly, JCVD, all that. And I really remember that really vividly being a thing. I remember in the late 90s, people being like, Tarantino's written this war movie. It's going to have all the old action heroes in it. And at the time, like, I was absolutely obsessed as a kid with Arnie and everything like that. Like, you know, I was a complete action movie fanatic. And I was like, oh, absolutely amazing. This is going to be incredible. And then, of course, that didn't happen. But I looked up on this today because I was like, oh, yeah, well, that's one of the great lost movies, surely, the version of Inglourious Basterds where, like, Arnie's playing Aldo Raid or something. You've got Stallone as the bad Jew. It would have been incredible. And then I found an interview from Tarantino from 2009 when Inglourious came out, actually saying, oh, no, that was never true. Like, that was, I never bandied those names about. That was never my intention for this film. And I was kind of like deflated, because I was kind of like, oh, I always thought that was like one of the great lost movies in my head, like the action heroes version of Inglourious Basterds. Kind of thing. Because I would have loved that, mate. I would have loved a version of Inglourious Basterds with all the old 80s action heroes like Sly and Arnie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's kind of interesting to think, you know, what could have been. And there are a lot of, you know, what if scenarios in Sly's career. And there's a lot of what if scenarios in Tarantino's. He's talked about projects that may or may not happen. He's talked about doing a Kill Bill 3, which I'm not really, I don't see the point of it. But again, with Tarantino, you know, he might do something, but it seems like, you know, the theme of vengeance is pretty common in the sense that, you know, vengeance begets vengeance and it creates this endless cycle. And I'm not really sure I want to see Beatrice, the bride, be on the receiving end of something like that.
I've got to be honest. Do we think that Uma's going to work with Tarantino again?
No. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, after the hell she went through on Kill Bill 2, it's terrible what happened to her there. It's really interesting, though, Liam, to see that, like, obviously, that era had an impact on Tarantino because he doesn't work with Lawrence Bender anymore either. And I'm not really sure why those two don't have a professional relationship anymore.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Lawrence Bender, is he like a producer or something?
Yeah, he was producer on, I don't know when he stopped. I think he was producer up through, I want to say, the Kill Bill movies.
Okay. Has he got Weinstein connections?
He might. It's, you know what? I haven't researched it enough. And it's just weird because they seemed like such a team for such a while. He's actually in Pulp Fiction when Tim Roth is hurting all of the customers of the coffee shop. There's a guy with two women. And I think he calls him a long-haired yuppie or something.
Right.
But if you watch that scene, that's Lawrence Bender, who's sort of being shoved into a corner. It's just really weird. Yeah, I think Uma Thurman might make it so we don't ever get a Kill Bill 3, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, but I really like the Kill Bill films, especially Volume 1. I mean, that's an interesting one, the Kill Bill movies, because, of course, when you had Ryan on, obviously he was very insistent about it being one movie. And obviously, I know it was originally intended as one film. But it's funny, like, because with Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, watching them now as two separate films, they do feel like two separate movies. Like, yep. And Tarantino, of course, described Volume 1 as his Eastern and Volume 2 as his Western at the time. And, like, I mean, literally, they feel completely different tones in many ways and different vibes. So the first one's like a full-on samurai action movie. Like, you know, it's pretty much all-out action. And the second one is a far slower-paced, far melancholic, kind of like, you know, kind of reveling more in dialogue and kind of, you know, character and stuff like that. And feels like, you know, even visually a different type of movie to the first one. So for me, I kind of almost feel if we ever did get that whole bloody cut or whatever it's called. Whole Bloody Affair. I kind of feel it would feel a bit weird, to be honest. Like, I've actually, you know, as much as we all know that Harvey Weinstein is an unrepentant cunt, like there's no getting around that at the end of the day. However, you know, in this case, I think he may have made the right decision splitting it in two. I kind of think it works. And the first film, for me, is the better film. I kind of think the film is just complete, like, a breathless, kind of endlessly exciting kind of action fest. And then the second film is the one that seems, and I do like the second film. It's grown on me a lot over the years. Like, the first time I saw it, it was slightly disappointing. But now, when I've watched it since, I'm like, oh no, I do like it. And it is kind of, I think in terms of the character of the bride, I think it is good. And actually, obviously, a lot of people complain about the final confrontation between Bill and the bride. And that apparently originally it was like a huge like fight sequence between them.
Yeah, on the beach there,
yeah. And it was cut down to this tiny little thing. And I've got to say, I actually am so glad it wasn't a massive kind of action sequence. Because number one, I'm not sure David Carradine could have pulled it off his age. Number two, I'm just kind of, you've already had that gigantic, amazing fight between her and Daryl Hannah earlier on in the film. And it's so, so good, so amazing. And I kind of feel it could only be a step down. And I think that kind of, that the fact that it's so fast, I kind of think it's good because it kind of shows that Bill, actually, he's got a bit long in the tooth and he's not the man he thought he was. And he's not the hot shit he kind of made out to be because she fucking takes him out like he's nothing because it's that whole thing of like he taught you, you know, what was called the triple heart punch or whatever. And yeah, I really like that she just fucking takes him out with one move. And he's fucking dead. I really, really like that. And I think it's so cool.
Yeah. And I also think that Bill knew that he needed to be punished for what he did.
Yes.
Not to say that he, you know, willfully lost, but I mean, I think Bill understood that it was his time. But you've also pointed out some great sequences in that movie, that the fight in the double wide trailer with Daryl Hannah, where the confined space is, you know, she doesn't even have room to open her sword at certain points. Really cool. And then, of course, the whole training sequence with Pai Mei.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, you just triggered a lot of great sequences in part two. But, you know, the other thing is of being a fan around that time, you know, Jackie Brown came out in 97. And then Kill Bill didn't come out until, what, 2003?
2003 is the volume one, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a really long wait. And I remember just being like, we're never going to get another movie. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Volume one, Kill Bill Volume One, first Tarantino film I saw in the cinema.
And that's an experience.
Yeah, completely. Like, because Jackie Brown, I saw on VHS when it came out as well, as a follow-up to Pulp Fiction. And yeah, Kill Bill Volume One, because that gap, by the time that came out, I would have been 18 and ready to see that in the cinema. And, yeah, it was incredible. And then obviously every QT film since, I've seen in the cinema. But, yeah, I mean, it's like, we'll talk about Uma a lot. Obviously, she's a big part of the first chapter in the, story, with Vincent and Maya. And, you know, I mean, that's so, I mean, they're so great together. They've got loads of chemistry, which is impressive considering, because obviously Travolta is already kind of, you know, at the time, of course, kind of past his heyday in many ways when this movie came out. You know, he's kind of revived his career. And again, he's so fucking good. He's so good in this movie.
The great thing about it is their scenes together from the minute he comes to pick her up, it's like a dance. They're dancing around a subject. They're, you know, he wants to talk about Tony Rakihara and what happened there and why Marcellus threw him off a balcony. So, you know, they're sort of dancing around getting to know each other. And then it culminates with them actually dancing.
Yeah. And you know what? It's that dance sequence where I watch it. I go, this is two people who can dance brilliantly, deliberately dancing kind of badly, in a kind of great way, as you watch it and you go, like, it's that thing of only two incredible dancers could kind of do this slightly awkward dance and make it look great, but at the same time realistically more like two people who aren't used to dancing as much.
Yeah,
it's just so fucking genius, and they are amazing. And you know, it's one of the things that struck me. I was like, at this point, Uma Thurman would have surely been really young. So there must be like 20 years between them or something, I would imagine.
15, I think it was probably close to 15 years, maybe. I mean,
15 years. But you don't feel it, do you? You don't feel the age difference between them in these scenes. You really kind of feel like they're on, I mean, I guess Travolta does look young. He does look youthful, like, you know, still. And I think the character of Vincent comes across as young as well in many ways. But yeah, you don't feel that age gap at all. One of the things I was thinking when I was watching this, I was like, do we think Vincent and Maya would have fucked if not for the overdose?
I'm of the opinion that Vince would have stuck to his plan that he sort of, you know, he expresses to himself in the mirror there. I truly think he would have maintained their honor, if you will. But it's a great question, and it really could go either way. And that's one of the beauties of that whole sequence is the whole push and pull and the dance that they go through.
Well, yeah, because when he actually comes back in, before he sees she's overdosed, you do hear him go, oh, so Mark, I've got to go. Like, yeah, he's already said straight in, like, I've got to go, I've got to go out of there. Because he knows that he can't say, because I think it's that thing, I think you're kind of right in terms of he knows how dangerous it would be to stay at the end of the day. Because he already knows what happened to the other guy. He ended up giving her a foot massage. So it's like, yeah, essentially, you're genuinely playing with your life. Like, you know, at this point. But there, at the same time, there is clearly a connection between them as well. And the moment where he has to jab the adrenaline shot into her, still one of the most intense moments of film I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, yeah. It's that's an amazing sequence. And you've got an amazing cast of characters in that room. You know, you've got Rosanna Arquette. And Eric Stoltz in his bathrobe there. That is a great scene. And I just love the chaos around trying to find the little black medical book and how he's prepared to do this, but he's unprepared at the same time. And that's another thing I really like about Pulp Fiction is the comedy isn't overt, but it's there. And it's there if you want to find it. There are points of Pulp Fiction where I'm sure I laugh where other people don't and vice versa. And I think that's an amazing thing. I mean, if you also look at like the scene where Vincent shoots Marvin in the face, it's a terrible sequence, but at the same time, there's a shitload of comedy there.
Oh, I think there's loads of comedy in Pulp Fiction. I think it's an incredibly funny film. It's one of those movies I point to where, you know, you get those films that aren't comedies, but they are some of the funniest films like you've ever seen in your life. Or funny, Sopranos as a TV show is a perfect example of this, where that is not a comedy officially, but mm-hmm. I would say The Sopranos is funnier than the majority of comedies.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so funny you mentioned that because, me and my wife did a rewatch of it recently. It was her first time watching the series and, you know, oh, wow. It was a rewatch for me. But yeah, the comedic situations in The Sopranos are wonderful. And the other thing about it too is the violence has a tendency to be funny too. And I don't mean that in that you're laughing at the violence that's happening to people, but sometimes it's so absurd that you have to laugh to prevent from being uncomfortable. I think a good example in The Sopranos is the scene where Richie cripples Beansy. He runs him over with his car. And that's a really hard sequence to watch, but there's comedy built around it.
Oh, yeah, nasty.
And then they get a bunch of jokes from it down the line. But yeah, I mean, Sopranos was like next level stuff. And I think Sopranos is as important to what happened in TV after it as much as Pulp Fiction is responsible for what happened in film after it. I think they're very good partners in that sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, well, I just to say The Sopranos is my favorite TV series of all time. And it's my favorite kind of piece of fiction of all time. Yeah. I prefer it to any book, movie, anything like that. And literally the moment I always think of The Sopranos in terms of immediately making its violence funny is literally the third episode where they're having the dispute with the Jewish guy.
And oh, yeah.
Paulie Walnuts grabs the bell off they're in a motel and he grabs the bell off the reception desk and starts banging him in the head with it, and so the bell is ringing as he's whacking him in the head, and just immediately I was like, it's hilarious, like, just like makes the violence so funny.
Yeah, well, and the other thing I really appreciate about The Sopranos, and I think Tarantino has a tendency to do this as well, is in The Sopranos, you didn't get an answer for everything, and I'm not just talking about the last episode. You know, there's a lot of unresolved plot points in the Sopranos that were intentionally left as unresolved. I think the biggest one people will talk about is the Russian in Pine Barrens, but it doesn't matter really. And I think that's, I wish that could be done more in cinema and TV, because that's real life. In real life, shit happens, and sometimes you don't know why it happens.
Yeah, you know, completely. And to bring it back to Pulp Fiction, we talked about funny moments. Like, one of the funniest in the whole film for me, moving into the Butch second chapter sequence, is when Butch realizes that his girlfriend has left the watch behind. Oh. The watch that, of course, Christopher Walken's character tells him his dad hid up his ass for years. Yeah. And Walken as well. He turns around to her and he says, he's like screaming. He's so angry. And he's thrown a TV like across the room. And he's like, you have no idea what my father went through for that watch. I haven't got time to go into it now, but he went through a lot. He's just fucking hilarious. Because he's quite a scary scene because he is being terrifying. He is like kind of like literally throwing a massive temper tantrum. And he's obviously like a very scary guy. But when he says that, it's just so hilarious because of the fact that we as an audience do know what his dad went through for the watch.
Yeah.
It's just so funny.
Yeah, and I also think that's a really good character moment for Butch, because ultimately he realizes that he has as much accountability for that as Fabian does, and he acknowledges sort of that he didn't express to her how important the watch was, and it all could have been avoided really if Butch had remembered to take it. But I think that's a really underlooked or undervalued Butch character moment, because it shows that he is working on himself. And I think the delivery from Bruce Willis there is great. And I think that's an example of what Bruce Willis can bring to a project as an actor. And I think, I don't think he gets enough credit sometimes for his acting. And I think a lot of that might be his own fault because of some of the projects he's chosen to make in the past 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, let's get straight. Willis is brilliant in this film. He is absolutely incredible. The problem with Willis is at a certain point, he stopped giving a fuck about the films and his performances that he was doing. And now it's at the point where, like, I think the last thing I'm going to see him in is Glass. And when I watched Glass, I genuinely was like, oh, have you forgotten how to act? Like, in terms of, like, literally, that's what it feels like. I'm like, it feels like beyond him not caring now, to the point that he's just like so doesn't care that he's just like, oh, I've just forgotten this skill now. Like, I haven't got it anymore. And it's so sad because you look back at performances like this and it reminds you what a brilliant kind of actor he was. He is an actor who, out of kind of, you know, the headline stars of the time, it's basically him and Mel Gibson who could bring a certain level of danger to their mm-hmm. performances and convincingly badass kind of interpretations. And it's just like, they have such edge, both of them, on the screen at that time. And they both fucked it up in different ways. And like, you know, and it's such a shame because he's so good here. I think Butch is such a tough son of a bitch, like, as a character. And, you know, and he's really fun to watch. And it's funny you say about that moment where he turns around to his girlfriend and he apologizes and he says, oh, you know, it wasn't your fault and everything. Because it doubles down that sequence and makes it even funnier by hard cutting from him being really nice to his girlfriend and being like, I'm so sorry, to him being in his car alone, being like, fuck you, stupid idiot, I told her I wanted to fucking watch, like, yeah. And he's absolutely going mental, like, in the car. And it just makes it even more hilarious. And yeah, I really like the Butch story in it. I think this is definitely something we should talk about. I think it's come up on your podcast before in terms of the sequence where Butch and Marcellus Wallace are held captive in the basement of the car pawn shop mm-hmm. is genuinely, I say it is still a frightening sequence, even now.
Oh. Absolutely.
Like, nerve shredding. And when I originally watched this, when I was like teen in the late 90s, it really freaked me out. Like, when they got down into that basement and they're tied up and they've got fucking ball gags in their mouths and everything like that, And then when he turns around and goes, oh, you know, go get the GIMP. And suddenly there's this weird, like, dungeon thing being opened and they're pulling the GIMP out. But I remember watching it and almost having, and having to, like, pause and walk away from it. I was kind of like, I'm out. Like, this has got too weird, too dark, too fucked up. And certainly at that time, I definitely had a real problem with, like, sexual violence in movies. Like, right. I found it really deeply disturbing, like, to watch, like, at that time. And I was just kind of like, holy shit. And I had to step away for a while and then come back and be like, okay, all right, kind of muster the energy to kind of take this sequence on. And, yeah, even rewatching it, like, say the moment where Butch goes upstairs, and obviously you get that great thing where it's like he's going to leave, but he can't. He can hear Marcellus's screams, and he's just like, I cannot leave him. And he selects his weapon, and he starts walking back down the stairs with the samurai sword. And literally, that scene, I'm like, you know what? Because what's frightening about it is actually we as an audience and Butch don't actually know at that point. Truly, we can take a guess, but we truly don't know what's happening behind that door. All we know is they have kind of locked, Zed and the other guy have kind of locked themselves in with Marcellus Wallace. And Marcellus Wallace is screaming, and clearly terrible things are being done to him. But we're not quite sure what is happening behind that door. And it feels like a horror movie at that point. Oh. And it feels so, so scary. Even though we know Butch is a hardcore guy and he's got a fucking samurai sword and he's free, we still feel scared for him as he enters that room.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. It's a wonderful sequence in terms of, like you said, you know, Tarantino's ability to shoot that sequence. Like you said, it feels like a horror movie. I don't think there's a sequence within that sequence where Tarantino didn't do the absolute right thing. One of my main things about Pulp Fiction, and I probably explained this on episode zero, was, you know, Pulp Fiction was a movie where I started to understand that there needed to be somebody on set there that made decisions on what we were seeing. And one of the great exercises with Pulp Fiction is, and a lot of this probably has to do with editor Sally Menke as well, is you don't feel the cuts in this movie. And that is a true sign of, to me, perfect direction. Every shot serves its purpose. And again, you don't feel them. It's not quick cuts or any of that, which, you know, hey, there's a time and a place for that kind of filmmaking. But Pulp Fiction is almost a movie where you don't blink, if you know what I mean. Like, you don't feel the camera cuts. And that, to me, is undeniable. You can't do it any better than that.
Yeah, no, completely agree. I mean, literally, when it comes down to Pulp Fiction, I have very few problems with the movie at the end of the day. I think it's near perfect, and there's literally only a couple of things I could do without. And funnily enough, two of them are in the Butch sequence. Is the scene in the taxi with Butch and the weirdo taxi driver who seems to be getting off on the fact that he's just killed a guy. Like, I'm just like, that scene, I'm just like, what? Why? Like, it just seems like a really odd scene to throw in. I'm like, why is his taxi driver some kind of, you know, sexual weirdo who's kind of like, you know, getting off on the fact that he's just killed someone? And then following that, the scene with his girlfriend, who I find to be an irritating character anyway.
I think most people do, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Where she's talking that weird sequence where she talks about wanting a pot belly. And I was like, what? Like, because when stuff like this starts getting talked about, I always feel we're getting an eye into Quentin Tarantino's own sexual fetishes. And oh, I absolutely. Like, you know, it's like, because I'm like, enough, we've already got to deal with your foot fetish, Quentin. Okay, I don't want more on my plate. And, you know, when he's talking about this pot belly thing, and then Butch is like, oh, if you had a pot belly, I'd punch you in it. and I'm just like, oh, this is getting really weird now at the end of the day. And the only other thing that I have a problem with is Tarantino's own cameo in the film, where it seems like an excuse for him to be able to say the N word like loads and loads of times. And I'm just kind of like, obviously there's, you know, there's been arguments about Tarantino using the N word in his films a lot, everything like that. However, I think a lot of that can be justified when it's kind of said by black characters for a purpose, like in Django Unchained and stuff like that, or for, you know, authenticity of character. But with this, it genuinely felt like I don't really believe that kind of that character would use that language around Jules anyway. And we're also shown that this character has a black wife.
Yes, Bonnie's black, yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't believe this character would use that word, like, all the time, kind of thing, like this. Or is it, you know, or is it a pseudo comment on, like, white guys being like, oh, I've got friends who are black, my wife's black, so I can say, you know. It just feels self-indulgent to me. It feels like Tarantino being like, oh, yeah, I get to say the N-word, like, in this film. And I'm just kind of like, hey, yeah, I don't need that. But like, apart from those things, I think it's close to a perfect film.
Yeah, no, and I hear you. And I almost wonder if that was like Jimmy, the Jimmy character, like that was sort of just a weird flex that, you know, like he knew for that couple of minutes they needed him so he could sort of flex in front of them and show off and act like a badass. It's interesting. I might have told this story already on the show, but Tarantino originally wanted to play Lance, the Eric Stoltz character.
Oh, okay.
And he ultimately decided against it because he wanted to direct that sequence. He didn't want to be an actor in the sequence where they are giving her the adrenaline shot.
Yeah.
So he decided to take the Jimmy part on. And that sequence, the Bonnie situation kitchen scene with Jimmy, was directed by Robert Rodriguez, who came by and lent a hand. I don't remember if at the time Rodriguez was still developing, I think it was Desperado. So he might have been at the studio or in proximity. But yeah, I know that Tarantino wanted somebody that he could trust behind the camera. And he knew that Rodriguez was the man for the job. And then Tarantino returned the favor on Sin City. He directed the sequence with Benicio del Toro's severed head.
Yes.
And Clive Owen in the car. And I believe on the DVD, they have that entire sequence. I think it's a complete roll of film at the time. I think it's 16 minutes maybe. And you can watch that whole sequence unedited. And I believe you hear Tarantino at certain points. Those are good critiques though, Liam. And I totally understand them. And it's funny. I've toyed with the idea of bringing on a non-fan. Ultimately, I've decided against it because I don't think that's the point of the show. This is more of a celebration. But at the same time, I would love to sort of give somebody the opportunity to completely dress down this movie. But I'm just not sure that I'm the man for that job.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And also, at the end of the day, if they don't like Pulp Fiction, they're wrong. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think it's weird. It's kind of become fashionable now for critics to dislike Tarantino. Like, he's become, weirdly, a bit of a punching bag for critics in recent years, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, where people kind of have turned against him. For me, I think it's very unfair, because, like I say, I truly don't believe, in terms of kind of his feature films that he's directed, you know, I'm not talking about things like fucking Four Rooms or anything like that, but in terms of his actual features that he's directed, I don't think there's a bad film amongst them. I really don't. And I think, although of course there's things you can criticize about them, I think at a certain point he's kind of been blamed for the influence that he had on cinema, because obviously there's lots of Tarantino imitators that came along that weren't good. Because, of course, there's only one Tarantino. He's a unique filmmaker. And right. I feel he's almost been blamed for that wave of movies now. And so he's kind of almost, people just kind of bunch him in with those, weirdly.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's, you know, it's blaming him for a situation that was created due to the success of his film. But beyond that, he has no control over it. And I think the way he's navigated his career since then, really showcases that he's a legit, you know, master of his craft, because I don't think many filmmakers, you'd be able to draw a straight line between Pulp Fiction and, let's say, Death Proof. You know, there's a lot of filmmakers that don't get that far out of their lane very often, but still succeed. And I know Tarantino's had a lot of things to say about his whole grindhouse experience, but I think that's more tempered by the failure of the project and not as much the failure of the two individual films. But that's for another discussion on another day. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that you can go to your movie shelf or your streaming library or whatever you, however you organize your movies. And, you know, if Pulp Fiction isn't something you're interested in, you know, there's plenty of other films in Tarantino's filmography that are going to fit the mood you're in that day.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, although there's a vibe and a style to his film, especially in the dialogue, you know, he's done a lot of very different films. I kind of feel like the chapter that we had of that almost trilogy of Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, and Hateful Eight were very, very different for him. And kind of, you know, because they were all period pieces. And I think they, although they have lots of Tarantino elements, I think they're a very different vibe to, like, his earlier films.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Inglourious, I think, gets better with every single watch. Like, I would now put Inglourious Basterds in my top three Tarantino.
You know what? That's really interesting, Liam, because that's a movie that I definitely need to watch again, because I remember seeing it in theaters and understanding and appreciate what Tarantino was doing, but ultimately I didn't feel the need to rush out and buy it the day it came out on DVD. Similarly, I had the same experience with Django Unchained, but during the past year, we watched it on Netflix here, me and my wife, and I absolutely understood the movie and gained a much greater appreciation for it. So I think I'm going to have to sit down and watch Inglourious Basterds again, because I think that's the Tarantino movie that I sort of give the least amount of attention to. And I know a lot of people hold it in very, very high regards.
I definitely would recommend returning to it, because like I say, like, it is one that I saw in the cinema and I really liked it, but not necessarily up there with his other films. And then since then, I've probably seen it like 5 times or something like that. And every single watch, it's got better and better and better. And the last time I watched it was when I was doing a whole season of Tarantino kind of films, all his movies leading up to the release of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And, yeah, I was like, holy shit, this film, like that bit at the end when he says, you know what, this may be my masterpiece. Like, every time I watch it, I get closer to be going, you might be right, Tarantino. You might be right. Like, in terms, for me, it's like, I don't think anything will ever touch my top two, which is Pulp Fiction at the top, Reservoir Dogs in second place. Uh-huh. Because I think those opening two movies of his career, there is just a purity and originality to those films that you're just never going to recapture again. And I kind of think that after that, once you get to kind of like Kill Bill's, Jackie Brown's a bit of a diversion into another world, it's almost like Tarantino as a filmmaker in that time away has become self-aware, and certainly self-aware of his own legacy and legend. You know, Kill Bill was the first one where we get the fourth film by Quentin Tarantino, which has become a thing now, where he will go, look, the so forth. And that is a man who knows that he is the star of the show. He is one of the few directors that can sell a movie on his name. And, like, it is that thing of going, I kind of think there's a danger to that when creators become self-aware enough to know what people kind of, what they're famous for and what people like of their kind of movies or just their output in general. And I kind of think that shows, even though I still love everything that's happened since, I think those first two movies, there's just a purity to them that is untouchable.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the one thing with Tarantino, at least more with his core fan base, and there's still a huge fan base based on the box office that we've seen, is Tarantino, unlike a lot of other filmmakers, I think he has a fan base that is willing to go down roads with him, even if they don't know where he's going. And, you know, a lot of people want their filmmakers to sort of stay in one lane. Look at like a filmmaker like Wes Craven. He was a horror guy. He made great horror films, and that's where his audience wanted him to stay. And I think Tarantino fans should be given a lot of credit for sort of going along for the ride with him. I think it's awesome, and I wish more fans would sort of commit to loving filmmakers regardless of what genre they're sort of, what sandbox they're playing in that week. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, completely. And I think if you love a director's work, I think you will go with them, kind of thing, down their avenues that they want to explore, even if it's not necessarily your vibe as much. I mean, with Tarantino, it's that thing of, you know, it's a funny thing that a lot of critics really love Jackie Brown, and they actually, a lot of critics really had strong things to say about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels as if, because I would say out of his movies, they're the two most un-Tarantino for the most part. And it's like, you know, they kind of have far less of the trademark Tarantino kind of dialogue. They're far more slower paced. Mm-hmm. than his other movies, everything like that. You know, they're both sort of hangout movies in a way. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think it's telling that critics are drawn to them to be like, oh yeah, well these are, it's almost like they're going, oh, these are proper films and those other films are Tarantino films. I'm like, yeah, but that's what I want from Tarantino. That's why I love him. That's what I come for. I want him to give me all the cool dialogue and everything like that. That's what I want. And I think, you know, it's maybe why those films are more near the bottom of my kind of Tarantino top 10, as it were, even though I still think they're extremely good films, than his others.
Right, right. That's interesting. I hold Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in very, very high esteem. It's probably in my top 5 Tarantino movies.
Wow.
It's always interesting to find somebody with a differing opinion. And I think right around the time this episode's coming out, we're going to be able to pick up Quentin's novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Have you heard about this?
Yeah. I mean, I must say, I'm really intrigued by the novelization. I'm really intrigued to read a novel by Tarantino or what that could be. And I will say that Hollywood, at the end of the day, I've only seen it once so far. I saw it in the cinema when it came out. I like I say, it, for me, it's probably out of his films the one I like the least.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's very good. Like, I still think it's a very good movie. It just literally just hasn't quite sat with me just yet in the same way as some of his other films. But I have no doubt that it will grow on me with kind of more watches. I think it will probably grow on me in the second watch, going in knowing more what I'm going to get.
Right.
In terms of kind of like, you knowing that I'm not getting a kind of a more standard Tarantino film, that it is a different vibe. I'll probably appreciate it more on second try, but I am really intrigued by the novelization.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. I can't wait to check it out. And then, not to get off into a whole nother thing here, but Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that climax for me is just pure perfection.
Oh, the climax is amazing. Yeah. The climax is incredible. Look, the climax is almost like what you pay the ticket for at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, a ride where you buy the ticket and you're like, okay, when are the big thrills? And you get those in spades at the end. I mean, every choice made at the end of that movie is perfect. Liam, I think you have helped me set a record here. I think this is the longest episode of Conversations at Jackrabbit Slims. And I feel like we could talk for another hour if we could. I know it's late where you are, so I appreciate you taking the time out to sit down with me and chat Pulp Fiction and lots of other things. The podcast is Spotlight. Again, I'll include a link to it in the show notes. And Liam, I hope we can sit down and chat at some point again, because this was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, 100%, mate. It's been a blast. And yeah, we could definitely go on. It's one of those ones. There's so much it's such a rich discussion point that you could definitely go on and on. But yeah, if you want to hear more from me, Spotlight, at Spotlight Pod on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and all the, kind of podcast, apps and such. I also review movies and TV on streaming services for the BBC on, BBC Radio Sussex and Surrey, which of course goes out on the BBC Sounds app as well. If you're in the UK, you can get hold of that as well and hear me on there occasionally.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I'll include a link to that if I can as well. Liam, thank you again.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure.